dark days are done and the bright days are here. My sunny one shines so sincere. Sunny one so true. I love you.
Our next guest is one of those rare talents who has something to say and can say it funny. He's a writer-performer on the new Laugh-In and one of the most popular, outspoken, and entertaining personalities on the local news here in Los Angeles. He's won a half a dozen Emmys as a film critic and host of his own shows. Let's welcome Mr. John Barber, right over there.
Thank you. This is John Barber. That was Sarita singing Sunny. And Frank Sinatra saying, here's Johnny, the night he hosted The Tonight Show, and I was his guest. Welcome to John Barber's World, live from Las Vegas. A number of years ago, I moved up here from Los Angeles, the city of angels, to the city of angles. This morning, as you all saw on television, the FBI, the Federal Bureau of Incompetence, announced they were looking at how the Russians influenced Trump's election, but avoided looking into how our media, in spite of all their efforts, could not stop Trump's election and totally ignored Hillary's sabotaging of Bernie Sanders' very likely nomination over the Wicked Witch. Along with all this distracting nonsense is the further nonsense of all this media time devoted to Obama's eavesdropping on Trump, our billionaire president. And not one line about what Snowden revealed to us years ago when he had to run for his life, telling us that they are eavesdropping on all of us. The reason the CIA and NSA are upset over the Russians spying on us is because that's their job, not some foreigners. With all these meaningless media attacks and now some citizens filing a court petition to invalidate Trump's election, Trump must feel like the producer of La La Land, who was told he had won the Oscar for Best Picture, only to hear a very loud, oops, sorry. Right now, we're going to hear a lot about eavesdropping from someone extremely knowledgeable about it. He was at the heart of it as the lead counsel to President Nixon and later as a private citizen. He called for the impeachment of George Bush when he learned that Bush was eavesdropping on Americans. I first had the distinct pleasure of interviewing our guest back in 1976 in Los Angeles. After serving Nixon, after Watergate, and after serving a year in prison, he wrote a historic, detailed, interesting book about it all called Blind Ambition. In 1979, Martin Sheen starred in the miniseries on TV, and I appeared as a reporter, reporting real, not fake news. Since then, he has had a remarkable, successful career as a best-selling writer, and one of the best of the bestsellers is Conservatives Without Conscience. He's a sought-after lecturer and political analyst, appearing often with Keith Olbermann and Randy Rhodes, and writer after us on MSNBC with Chris Hayes. When we posted his appearance on Facebook, we had a flood of interesting notes and questions from listeners. Now, one lady, Diane, asked me if I thought he'd been a traitor to our nation, the United States of America. My response to Diane was that our nation was not the USA. Our nation is the Constitution, so we'll have to ask him about that. But bigger traitors to the Constitution, I told Diane, would have to be LBJ, both Bushes, Richard Nixon, and Ronald Reagan, who sabotaged Jimmy Carter's run at a re-election with his traitorous dealings with Iran over the hostage crisis. Believe me, we could build a Guantanamo just to house our politicians. With Snowden and scores of dedicated Americans like our guest, we see that it seems to be outstanding, ordinary private citizens, and not our presidents, who are trying to drag us back into a functional democracy. It is indeed a pleasure for me to once again be talking to one of these involved, very talented citizens, John Dean. John, welcome to the show. It is indeed a delight to be talking to you again.
Nice to be back with you, John. You've got a great soapbox, it sounds like.
Well, I'm sure you will. I'm sure you will love being back on with me. Time flies, John. Trouble multiplies.
You got most of that intro right. Not all of it, but close.
Well, listen, you can correct all of the things that I didn't get right. But the first time I talked to you back in 1976, I was actually scheduled to talk to your gorgeous wife, Mo, who had written a book. But unfortunately, she was not well that night, and you filled in. And you were just wonderful. Folks absolutely loved you. So I have to ask you right off, how is Mo today?
Mo is terrific. She's a beautiful lady, and we've been married so many years I've lost count. I think it's getting up around 50 now.
Were you married to Mo when you first began to work for Richard Nixon?
I got married. No, I was married in 72. Got married while I was at the White House.
To Mo?
Yes.
What was her reaction? And you had a young son at the time, did you not?
Yes.
How old is he?
He's 50 now.
We've
got three granddaughters
who are
still teens. We've got the oldest is 19 and next week turns 20. The middle one is 16 and the youngest is 13.
What are their names?
There's Molly, Sally, and Franny.
What do they think, John, when they look back at your history and see that you got in a lot of serious trouble?
John, we've never really talked much about it. I recently did an interactive audio-video hookup to do a class. There's an advanced placement class where Sally's in school, and her teacher learned who I was and asked if I would come do a class for them. That's the first time I've ever done a high school class, but it was fun. They're bright kids, had good questions. They actually combined a couple classes. And you're wrong. I never went to prison. I was in the witness protection program. So when the government was more concerned about keeping me alive than sending me off.
When you were in the witness protection program, what was your nickname?
I didn't get a picket fence house and a new identity. I got two marshals that live with Mo and I 24/7.
Oh my gosh, how interesting was that? When you got your job, your first job as counsel to Richard Nixon, what did you think it would be like, and did it slowly dawn on you, or did it dawn on you at all that perhaps you folks were doing something that you shouldn't have been doing, something that might have been unconstitutional?
No, it did not. In fact, my head is back in this. I did a book, my last book. I actually transcribed, I got a team of grad students, and I went in and dug out all the Watergate secret tapes that Nixon had recorded. And there were about 600 tapes that nobody had ever, I think, outside of the National Archives ever listened to. And some of the other ones, about 400 others, there were varying degrees of accurate transcripts of those. So I went through all of about 1,000 conversations from literally the day of the first day Nixon is back after the arrest at the Watergate until they pulled the plug. After the taping system was revealed in July of 73. So that's from June 17th of 72 till July of 73. And it's about 4 million words from which I drew down the narrative and dialogue for a book that is called The Nixon Defense and really explains what Nixon knew and when he knew it. When I first got there as White House counsel, Richard Nixon was the new Richard Nixon. The old Tricky Dick had disappeared, or at least we all thought. It took me, the White House counsel was then and still is a middle-level staff job, so you don't have a lot of access to the president. So I didn't really get to meet him and get to know who he was, because I would go in with group meetings or with his chief of staff, Bob Haldeman, or his top domestic advisor and my predecessor as White House counsel, John Ehrlichman. So I didn't really have a lot of one-on-one with him the first couple of years I was there, and nothing seemed astray. In the book you mentioned that they made the series out of, Blind Ambition, I laid all that out. It's interesting how what happens with the passage of time. Based on my last book, where I filled in a lot of blanks that I didn't know when I wrote Blind Ambition, ABC TV is currently developing a new series. So we're going to have another shot at it.
Oh, well, that's wonderful. I have always wanted to ask one very simple question of you, or either Haldeman or Ehrlichman or Nixon. And it was based on an interview with Nixon's speechwriter, whom I interviewed on television back about the time I interviewed you. What was the real reason for the Watergate break-in, to your knowledge?
There was never any direction given out of the White House for it. The White House had to figure out what had happened like everybody else after it happened. Didn't take very long for us to figure it out, because the White House was aware that there was an intelligence-gathering operation at the re-election committee. And best I can tell from all those tapes, as well as contemporary conversations, is it was a pure fishing expedition. They were just in there looking for anything they might find. The Watergate was not their real mission the night they were arrested. In fact, where they were really headed was to Senator George McGovern, who was running against Nixon, that his campaign offices on Capitol Hill, where they're going to try to bug that. Had they not been arrested at the Watergate, they might have been arrested in George McGovern's headquarters, and we wouldn't have had Watergate. We'd have had a scandal by some other name.
Well, I'll tell you the reason I asked it. In this book that he wrote, which did become a bestseller also, in only three sentences in the book, he said the reason he felt that they broke into the Watergate was because of Larry O'Brien's files. And these were the files that Larry O'Brien had made, the notes he had made, because it was Larry O'Brien along with Robert Mayhew who put a hit team together. They met at the Desert Inn Hotel, according to this fellow, with John Roselli, some CIA folks, some mafia folks, to plan the hit on Fidel Castro.
And that baloney. Baloney.
Baloney. Okay. Oh, so...
Well, it just doesn't make any sense. And I talked to all the players who were involved at the time, talked to Mitchell, who approved the money for the intelligence-gathering operation, talked to Jeb Magruder, who actually gave the order to break in the Watergate. He had no idea of anything like that. Who is the speechwriter you're talking about?
I can't remember his name offhand.
Well, there are a couple speechwriters. There was Ray Price. I doubted he would have said that. Pat Buchanan was a speechwriter.
No, it wasn't Pat.
Ben Stein was a speechwriter.
It might have been Ray Price. It wasn't Stein, and it wasn't Buchanan. So let me ask you this question, since you mentioned Haldeman. In Haldeman's book, I recall that Nixon often used the phrase, this Bay of Pigs thing. Why would he have used that phrase? And some folks seem to think it was some kind of code word for this Dallas thing. Does that make any sense?
Not at all. I know exactly when that came up in the conversations, in the tapes. I've looked at that issue. And what Nixon thought, Nixon had made an effort through Ehrlichman to try to get what was known as the family jewels at the CIA. They were all the things that had happened that had gone wrong, including the Bay of Pigs. Howard Hunt, who was involved in the Watergate break-in in his earlier career at the CIA, had been in charge of the Cuban Americans who helped launch the Bay of Pigs, and he had actually drawn from people of that. What Nixon uses the line Bay of Pigs because he thinks it's one of the most, he thinks it's embarrassing for the CIA. He knows that they've refused to turn over files. So on on June 23rd, in a conversation with Haldeman, it would actually become known as the famous smoking gun conversation when the tape actually came out. One of the things that he's doing in that conversation is Haldeman is encouraging him to have the CIA go to the FBI and get them to block the investigation into some contributors whose money had gotten commingled accidentally with the Watergate operation. So to get them, to persuade them to help, Nixon tells Haldeman to remind them that if this thing goes forward, the FBI is likely to soon be investigating the Bay of Pigs and all that stuff. So that's where that phrase came in. And it really had, the conspiracy buffs have liked to make more of it than really exists there. People have trouble believing Watergate was as stupid as it really was. But it is as stupid as it actually was. And you can't dress it up into anything more clever than a bungled burglary and an equally bungled cover-up.
It sounds like a Peter Sellers movie, for crying out loud.
Keystone Cop stuff.
What were your impressions of E. Howard Hunt? Do you think E. Howard Hunt was more involved in some dirty tricks in America than Watergate?
I doubt it. I actually, at one point post-Watergate, I was fairly active in lecturing, and my lecture agent asked me, who also represented Howard Hunt, I had a lot of lecture dates, and he asked me if I'd be willing to have Howard come along on some of those and get some engagements. And I said, sure. So I traveled with Howard, going from one school to another. And that's the first time I really got to know him. And he wasn't a bad guy. He was intelligent. He was something of a dreamer. Watergate was probably as great a tragedy for him as anybody, given the fact he had his wife assisting in paying the people he'd brought in, the Cuban Americans, to get involved in it. She flew off to Chicago to pass on $50,000, and she went down in a United airplane flight. And so she lost her life over it. And he was stuck with young kids and what have you. And so it was a pretty rough time for Howard. But I never saw him anything other than, you know, just an operative at the CIA. He was not particularly successful with his career there. He'd been moved around to a lot of stations, but was a sort of a workaday spy and handled lots of accounts, and particularly throughout Latin America, but not any kind of master conspiracy coordinator of any kind.
Well, he might have also been a sort of a bit of a bungler also. Have you ever heard of Mark Lane's book, Plausible Denial, about the trial in Florida, the libel trial that E. Howard Hunt brought against Spotlight?
John, you need to join the Trump administration with all these conspiracies that you're into. I have. Mark Lane is, and I don't buy any of them. I'm not a conspiracy theorist at all. I've seen real conspiracies, so I don't have to defame them fake them.
That is funny. The reason I say that is because evidently, Victor Marchetti had written an article in Spotlight saying that E. Howard Hunt was a bagman that supposedly delivered the funds to the shooters at a motel in Dallas, and he sued them. And
well,
he's
down there with Ted Cruz's father, huh?
Yeah, but he won $600,000, and Spotlight hired Mark Lane, and then the jury reversed the decision and found him guilty, and it appeared in Mark Lane's book. So that's why I bring that up, asking if you thought he was involved.
Nothing to it. No truth to it.
Okay.
No truth to it.
If you look back historically at Richard Nixon? How would you evaluate him? And why would you, I heard a really interesting radio interview you did last week. You made reference to the fact that Donald Trump may be the next Richard Nixon. How do you
evaluate? Well, I think Donald Trump's going to make Nixon look pretty good.
In what way?
Well, first of all, Trump is probably the least qualified man we've ever had become president. He is clearly an authoritarian personality, which Nixon was also, so there's a similarity there. I'd say that Nixon was about a six to a seven on the scale of 10 of authoritarianism. Trump is a 10 on a scale of 10, but there's
yes.
a big difference in them because Nixon was very knowledgeable about government. He'd been vice president before he was president. He'd been a member. He'd been in the Senate and the House. He was an accomplished lawyer. He'd argued cases in front of the Supreme Court. He understood how Washington works. I'm not sure Donald Trump, you can tell from some of his remarks, even has a good newspaper knowledge of how Washington actually works. He is learning on the job, and being president of the United States is not a good place to learn how the presidency works. He's a man who does not read. He does not read. I'm sure he's never read a biography or autobiography of any of his 44 predecessors. He doesn't want briefing books. He wants everything reduced to one page. And unfortunately, you can't be very effective as president with no knowledge. And gut instinct is just not going to work. So I just can't believe this is all going to turn out well, the way it started.
John, can you just see his first State of the Union? He will tweet it. It'll be the shortest State of the Union in history. So
we'll be lucky. We'd be better off if he did.
Well, how long do you think, honestly, he's going to last?
No telling. I think this Russian thing is got. I think it's potentially more serious than Watergate. The implications of it are much more dire. You know, Ben Bradley, who was the editor of the Washington Post during Watergate, I happened to see him at a social event at his home a couple years before he passed away, while he had some dementia problems at the end. It was a night when he was sharp and all the cylinders were firing. And we had this great talk, and he was talking about, you know, the aftermath of Watergate and the thing that had really disturbed him most in the aftermath was Iran-Contra, where during the Reagan years, where he thought, which he thought was much more serious than Watergate because of the national security implications of it. Watergate was truly a bungled burglary and a equally bungled cover-up. No national security implications, no true constitutional crisis. Nixon made that clear when he accepted the Supreme Court's ruling to turn over his tapes, turned them over, knew it was over, and left and resigned. I'm not sure if Trump is found... is impeached, he'll even leave. He'll say, I'm commander-in-chief. This is my army. You don't have any power up here on the Hill or at the courts, and we'll just work this out my way. So
okay,
who knows what's going to happen?
Let's supposing he does not last for one reason or another. Then your thoughts on his predecessor, Pence.
I don't know much about Pence. He's clearly a hard right personality who never could have, I don't think ever would have gotten the nomination to be president on his own. So it would be much like Gerald Ford getting the presidency. He'd inherit it. And whether he could ever get a second term or not is problematic to me. So it would be a short-lived presidency.
Then... what, you sound so positive about the future, obviously, for your three granddaughters, but somehow or another, the things you talk about don't augur well for the future. What do you
I'm as concerned about the future for them as I have ever been. I never had any concern about Nixon being dangerous as president. A lot of people thought that he was. He really was not. He had great respect for the office. I'll give you an example. This is a good one to, as we bring to the close here, of how much he really respected the office. He hired a guy to advise him on how to maximize the PR aspect of the presidency. And I once saw him at a press conference, and this guy he had just hired was there, and we were in the East Room. We were standing against the back wall and kind of chatting, and he told me that he tried to convince the president to wear a blue shirt that night for the press conference because it wouldn't make his features as harsh as a white shirt. And then this guy told me, he said, you know, Nixon turned to me, he said, presidents do not wear blue shirts. They wear white shirts. So that's the way he felt, you know, anything to respect the office. We're already seeing with Trump the norms and customs and practices of the office crumble. His last press conference in February, I'd never seen anything like it, where he is slowly desecrating the office. It's quite remarkable.
Do you think then, okay, let's supposing that Trump is an embarrassment to the office, but aren't the criticisms of Trump by the media and private citizens marching also an embarrassment to the office?
Well, they're called for because what's happening in the office? This man won't listen to anybody. He marches to his own drummer. He thinks he's got answers. He thinks he's smarter than his generals. He is in a fight with his intelligence community, which he thinks he knows more than, which is silly, and he's degrading everything about the office as well as the long bureaucracy in Washington, which is not really a partisan bureaucracy. These are people who, just like him, take an oath of office to support and defend the Constitution. They'll do it. I'm not so sure about him.
Okay, I have two quick last questions. First of all, do you think the CIA supports the Constitution? Do you think of...
Absolutely. Absolutely. I know a lot of agents have given their life, John, to help this protect this country. That wall that Trump stood in front of with the stars on marked the lives of the agents that have been lost trying to get information to help protect this country that cost them their life. Those are patriots. They're men and women who did nothing but honor the Constitution.
Well, John, your work and your life has revealed that you're a patriot also, and you must have encountered a great deal of personal and professional difficulty when you were suggesting that they impeach George Bush because he was eavesdropping on Americans. Where can people go?
No, actually, I got a lot of support from that. That was in a book I wrote called Worse Than Watergate, which about the Bush presidency, and it got the title Worse Than Watergate because I don't think Richard Nixon, in his darkest day, would have authorized war crimes and the use of torture.
Well, bless you for that, John, and thank you so much for being here. Where can folks go to read your stuff, to listen to your stuff, and to buy your books? And you're
just look at my handle on Twitter, which is @ John W. Dean.
Okay. And again, thank you so much. My very best to Mo and to you. And good luck tonight on MSNBC. Chris Hayes is going to have a fantastic guest. Best of luck
thank
to you, John. Thank you, John.
Nice visiting. Bye.
Bye-bye. We will be right back with the incomparable Joe Satilli.
Great music. All the greatest performers from sunup to sundown.
How do you keep the music playing
at last?
Well, beyond the sea.
Then, great talk all night. The mysteries of UFOs, conspiracy theories, and the true story of Las Vegas that has never been told.
There are three ways to listen to KIYQ.
go to the TuneIn app, just search for KIYQ, or go to www.kiyq.org. Listen from any telephone, call 605-477-2857. That's 605-477-2857. Long distance charges may apply.
KIYQ 107.1.
Hi, this is John Barber of John Barber's World every other Monday at 5 p.m. Pacific right here on VBS Radio. I'm telling you about a terrific show, The New Criminal Minds with outstanding actor Gary Sinise, called Criminal Minds Beyond Borders, a tough drama about a special unit of the FBI involved in protecting Americans who are beyond borders. It follows the regular Criminal Minds, airing every Wednesday at 10 p.m. Eastern, 9 Central. Don't miss it. Gary Sinise is outstanding.
Hi, I'm Richard Valzer. This is the great VBS Radio.
Thank you for that smile upon your face. Oh, sunny.
Hi, this is John Barber. You may remember me as the co-host, producer, and creator of Real People, America's first reality show, or most recently as the writer-director of what's been called the definitive documentary on JFK's murder, The Last Word on the Assassination. Now I'm doing a show every other Monday from 5 to 6 Pacific Time on BBS. You'll hear provocative views, unreported news, and film reviews from me, with outstanding guests and you. Join me on John Barber's World.
You're listening to BBS Radio. If it's not mainstream, it's on bbsradio.com.
Those of you who have an ongoing interest in the JFK assassination might want to know about this. TV producer John Barber. He put together a dream team of JFK researchers, including Coast regular Jim Mars and world-class JFK writers Dick Russell and Joan Mellon. They all got together at UNLV in front of a live audience. They had a screening of Barber's terrific, and I'd say historic, film based on interviews with prosecutor Jim Garrison of New Orleans. And then after the film was shown, the experts all talked about the latest JFK theories and evidence. It's now out on a DVD. Terrific stuff. I'm George Knapp, Coast to Coast AM.
Hi, this is John Barber again, back with John Barber's World live from Las Vegas. We just spoke to John Dean, former counsel of Richard Nixon, who's supposedly the person who actually helped bring him down. I'm joined now by the best journalist I know, the creator of News Vandal, the best daily newsletter out there, Joe Satilli. Joe, welcome to the show. Because John had to leave and do MSNBC and the Chris Hayes show, and I asked him about would the CIA lie under oath or about the deep state, and he said they would not. And it is obvious that the CIA would lie under any conditions to do what they do. He brought up Family Jewels, a CIA program. That CIA program is outlined vividly in part two of the Garrison tapes called The American Media and the Second Assassination of President John F. Kennedy. And the Family Jewels was a program developed by the Central Intelligence Agency on how to murder heads of state. They were successful in murdering Mossadegh in Iran. They did the same with Arbenz in Guatemala and with Allende in Chile. And Jim Garrison in the documentary says, and they still murder in the United States. And obviously, John Dean probably wouldn't accept that. I'm sorry I didn't get a chance to confront him with that. And I have a number of Facebook messages blaming me for being a coward by not confronting him.
That was under Schlesinger, right?
That was like the
program developed under Schlesinger and this counterintelligence thing that was domestic and foreign. I think the thing we have to remember about John Dean, and I had a, and he won't remember this, but in 2004, I was working on a film called Honored Betrayed. It was retired military speaking out against the Bush administration and what they felt was the transgressing of the Pentagon by the civilian leadership inside the Bush administration at that time, which I think there's a very good argument. As a matter of fact, there are two interesting things about that. If you think about Valerie Plame, how do you explain Valerie Plame? Well, Valerie Plame is an outgrowth of the CIA trying to find a way to counterattack the Bush administration, which laid the blame for the faulty intelligence, so-called faulty intelligence, that led to the supposed case for war against Saddam Hussein, the aluminum tubes and all that. Even though you had reporters busting open the fact that the aluminum tubes was horse hockey, it was total crap. But they blamed the CIA. And what they were doing in the Bush administration was neutering the CIA and turning it into a fall guy, because they were moving all of those operations over to the Defense Intelligence Agency under Rumsfeld. And then they were also privatizing these to private corporations like CACI and Lockheed and others that were conducting what used to be in the 60s and 50s and the 70s CIA operations, which could really no longer be statutorily conducted. And so these limits that came out of the exposure of the family jewels, ironically, the family jewels that John Dean kind of seems to not really want to get involved in, because ultimately, what's John Dean? He's a Boy Scout. He's a true believer. And he's a, he, you know, he bleeds red, white, and blue, and mom, and Chevrolet, and apple pie. And on some level, it's a bit refreshing because we don't really have that many Boy Scouts anymore. I still think there are Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts working in the intelligence agencies and in the FBI. Not enough to where they can control the course of these agencies, but I think there are more of them now than there probably ever was, because over time, the restrictions that came out of the exposure of all of the malfeasance that was going on with the FBI under Hoover and the CIA under a number of very, a lot of scumbaggery that was going on in the CIA over the years that you know almost better than anybody. By the time you get to the 90s, these agencies had to become professionalized and constrained, which is why you get the growth of contractors. And the growth of contractors allowed for a layer of plausible deniability for political leadership that no longer had to use the CIA to conduct their dirty tricks, because they could actually turn to private contractors to do them. And oh, double bonus here, the twofer, a lot of their buddies were making money off of the private contracting companies like DynCorp. Another one, a famous one, is Blackwater. So it's a twofer. Not only do you get plausible deniability from what you want to get done, you don't get your hands dirty, but also you and your buddies make a profit off.
Well, I was quite surprised that he found serious problems. Well, I'm not surprised that he found serious problems with Trump, but he seemed to find no problems with the system.
Yeah. Well, look, here's the thing. Again, he's of a different era and of a different time when John Dean came up. I mean, I think about, you know, my first memories, and this is just an oddity of my life. I was born in 1969. I actually remember watching Watergate hearings on the television. And I, you know, this is when they didn't realize little Joey needed glasses. They'd be, you're sitting too close to the television. I'm sitting too close to the television watching the Watergate hearings, which tells you why I'm the cuckoo bird I am today. But there's, you know, the images of John Dean with that wonderful sort of 50s style haircut and those rimmed glasses and looking like somebody in a moral crisis, right? Which is one of the reasons why he was such a good sell for that investigation, as he was such a great witness. And I think, John, what you see now is that people who still want to have that true believer's belief in the system are seeing the system seemingly under attack at every level by a presidency that I'm not sure has a coherent strategy for attacking the system so much as a presidency that is in the service of
an insane narcissist who has turned the White House into a selfie stick.
That is so funny, and it's so true. Now, your impressions of his impressions of Trump.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think Trump is now – I think we're maybe now getting a clearer picture. I have to tell you this. I'll be honest with you. I thought that Trump was likely to be a disaster. And, you know, there's only one issue to me that I could ever imagine voting on, and that's on the environment, because damage that happens to the environment is not damage that can be undone by another election. If, let's say, that he destroys the healthcare system, well, you can have another election, and I think one of the things that's a possible outcome of this repeal and replace is that you could have a backlash that creates a drive for a single payer system. On the environment, there are things that just you can't change with another election. But there was a 72-hour period after his bungled inauguration, because it was bungled, and the whole thing about, you know, I have to, you know, the size of my election is bigger than the size of my opponent's election, and, you know, all that stuff. He was talking to pipe fitters and to construction workers in the White House, and he was talking to people about jobs and infrastructure spending. And I thought for a split second, I said, you know what, he could pull this thing off. If he stays on this message, blue collar manufacturing revival, even though I think that fundamentally it's a flawed economic strategy because we're moving beyond that economic paradigm into automation, but fine, I thought he could make it work. Then he's just gone off the rails, John. I mean, today in the hearings, here's Comey, a guy who on some level contributed to the despair around the supporters of Hillary Clinton for Hillary Clinton's candidacy when he brought up Anthony Weiner and emails 10 days out from the election. People said, God, we don't want 4 years of Anthony Weiner and email scandals. We're just going to stay home. And I think that contributed to Hillary Clinton's loss because of all the fundamental flaws. Comey exposed those. Well, here's today Comey saying, no, we have no evidence that President Obama ordered wiretapping of Trump. And then his press secretary, Sean Spicer, comes out and reiterates their case that there's going to be new revelations. Well, we know that he got the information from watching Fox News. So now we're starting to see that Donald Trump is in sort of a perpetual feedback loop with the media he consumes. And that he's not actually engaged in any kind of radical transformation of American life and society, that he's really just there to look in the mirror. And so in some ways, I think that guys like John Dean.
Hey, Joe, wouldn't it be funny if he was like Peter Sellers in Being There?
Being There, exactly. That's what he is. He's Chauncey Gardner.
Yeah, he's Chauncey, and all he does is sit and watch Fox News.
What he is.
That's what he thinks the world is, and he comes out and tells us what the world is like.
That's right, and this is why he's in this constant – I wrote a piece last week for Consortium News about this, because I could tell you the media is playing right along. Why? Because they make money off of this, because it's like – basically what he is he's kind of like a weird Don King who's constantly promoting the next fight. He's promoting the next fight. He's promoting the next fight. You're on a cliffhanger, and you're like, I got to tune in and see the next fight. And so he says something crazy on Twitter. The media goes, oh, my God, he said something crazy on Twitter. He criticizes the media for criticizing he said something crazy on Twitter. The media says, can you believe he's criticizing us for criticizing him for saying something crazy on Twitter? And they just keep going in this cycle. And it's cheap television for the news media because they never have to leave Washington, D.C. They have all their assets there. And Donald Trump gets the pleasure of knowing that the whole world is obsessing on Donald Trump. And meanwhile, you have people like John Dean going, oh, I mean, the whole, you know, constitutional way of life is under threat. And I just wonder if maybe that's not exactly what's going on. Maybe we're just stuck in a weird feedback loop with a narcissist.
Well, it is totally bizarre. It is totally, and it is totally unnerving.
It is unnerving. I'll be here. You know, this is the second time I said I'll be honest with you. I do a pretty good job of divorcing myself from what's happening in DC. I don't like to say, you know, we bombed this or we did that. I like to say the administration did X or the administration did Y. But I have to say, on Friday, I did have a little moment of existential crisis when Angela Merkel, the leader of Germany, one of America's strongest allies, and by the way, has sent Germans to go fight in America's war in Afghanistan on behalf of America. Everybody in this White House press photo op is saying, oh, handshake, handshake, handshake. And Angela turns over and says, oh, they're asking for a handshake. And Donald Trump looks down like an 11-year-old petulant boy who refuses to look at somebody who wouldn't share his lunch with him. And it was just, I was like, my gosh, is this really what this guy thinks the presidency is about? And this is one place where I think John Dean is true. Is right. He's correct. There's truth. I don't think that Donald Trump has a concept of what the presidency is at all outside of his own sense of himself. So I think that in some ways we become histrionic about things, that Donald Trump is ruining X and destroying X and whatnot. When actually, if you go out into the world and you go to a park and you watch kids playing baseball, or you go to the store and you go and get yourself frozen pizza or whatever, really, the society is actually functioning and working. It's this obsession with Donald Trump's obsession with himself, which is causing us all to participate in his mania.
The most disturbing thing to me about Donald Trump, while certainly you don't want to see Hillary in there, it would have been much more interesting if it had been a real campaign and Bernie Sanders had broken off and created a third party. But the fact that Donald Trump not only does not read, but he takes pride in the fact that he does not read, tells you one thing basically about that person. That tells you that person thinks he knows it all and does not want to learn anything. And yet you look at somebody like John Kennedy, who is a multimillionaire, never took his salary as the president of the United States, donated his entire salary to charities, writes one of the greatest books that a president could ever write, Profiles in Courage.
I think, John, it is such a great point. And even for somebody like me, I came of age politically in the 80s. I was obsessed with Iran-Contra. I was obsessed with the October Surprise. I did not like Ronald Reagan. But at least Ronald Reagan had a worldview that in some ways had a logical basis. He read Paul Kirk, Conscience of a Conservative. He was a devotee of Barry Goldwater. They had an idea, an intellectual foundation. You may not agree with their worldview, but there was a worldview outside of the person themselves. Ronald Reagan's worldview was not a reflection of Ronald Reagan's desire to have the world be a reflection of Ronald Reagan. And so I think you make just a great point, because almost all of our presidents, and you know, George W. Bush, not that intellectually curious, but was actually reading biographies of other presidents throughout his presidency. That's something. I'll take that.
Yes, even though they were in the form of classic comics.
Yeah, exactly. Pop-up books, right? So
now with Trump, you have a really interesting article in your News Vandal today, which sort of surprised me, but I'm not quite sure it surprised me, about the fact that Trump was adopting a hands-off style on military operations. That sort of surprised me.
Well, I think what they're saying is that in the article is basically saying that he is continuing the kinds of a type of military policy that echoes his predecessors, particularly Obama, but also George W. Bush. And really I think that, you know how he always says, I'm going to listen to the generals. I think some of this may be a little bit of post-Yemen raid spin, because that Yemen raid was way worse than was reported here. There is a story in The Intercept by Ionia Craig, and she went to the village and talks about from the perspective of a five-year-old boy who in the middle of the night, all of a sudden, all hell breaks loose in the village, and he and his mother get up to leave their home, and as they're running out of the home, he watches his mother get hit, her head split in two from a shot from behind, and fall dead in front of him. And everybody in the village is talking about that dog, Trump, who killed. We're talking about, I think, 10 children under the age of 13 killed by SEAL Team 6 in that raid. And that was a decision that was made at dinner with Jared Kushner. So in between courses, they decide to greenlight that. And I think that there's an element here of the administration also trying to send out a signal that they're turning over things to the military. Because what did Trump do after that raid? Instead of taking responsibility, he said, as the member of the SEAL Team 6 who died, he said, the generals lost him. They lost him. And he blamed the generals for that raid. And I think that kind of rift between yourself and the military leadership is almost irreparable. And I thought that there was a little bit of an insider spin happening here where Trump is trying to distance himself from what is coming, which is perhaps some really, really bad stuff down the road. Because, by the way, he is ramping up in Yemen. He is ramping up in Syria. He is taking the fight. This is not a peacemaker, you know, non-interventionist administration, but I think there's an element of him trying to create his own level of plausible deniability between the decision-making process and the outcomes.
And if he does not read, if he knows nothing about the presidency or the history of the presidency or how the presidency should operate, what on earth does he know about Yemen? What does he know about Iran? What does he know about anything?
And this is actually, I think, where guys like John Dean shudder, right? This is why they start to say, well, whether it's a deep state or not, or a shallow state, I don't think it's a deep state. I think the deep state happens in boardrooms and in country clubs and on golf courses where financiers and businessmen get together with people who implement the military industrial complex and people like at Lockheed. That's where it happens. And then those policies get implemented through lobbying and campaign funds. But I would say that this is where John Dean and others get recalcitrant in their protection of the intelligence agencies and the national security state and all the functional parts of the government, because they think this guy may actually be such a bull in a china shop that he can destroy the normal previously acceptable levers of power as they implement policy in the United States and around the world. And they're afraid that is being tossed away.
I wish I had asked him what I asked Jim Garrison back in 1981, does John Dean think the president runs the United States?
Yeah, well, that's the crucial question, right?
I would really be interested in his answer. So what I may do is I may send him an email. Anyway, Joe, thank you once again for an absolutely terrific show. I'd be lost here without you. I want to thank Mike Kim, my producer, and BBS Radio for allowing us to do this show. When do they hear you next again? I guess it's tomorrow on Ocelli?
Yeah, tomorrow at 6 p.m. Pacific on Ocelli American Freedom Radio, and then every Tuesday, 2 p.m. Excuse me, every Friday, 2 p.m. Pacific on Crew FM. And, of course, folks, the great John Barber, big film coming out soon. You should look forward for that. And John, as ever, thank you very much for the opportunity to be your sidekick.
Oh, well, listen, I couldn't do it without you. I learn so much every day. I would like to say, as Ed Murrow said, good night and good luck. But I think I'll say what I said to John Dean when I introduced him after talking to him in 1976. Time flies. Trouble multiplies. Have a good night. Talk to you in 2 weeks. Bye-bye.
You're my spark of nature's fire. You're my sweet, complete desire. A sunny, 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 sunny.